Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
From little things, big things grow. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Right Now Radio on this sunny Melbourne evening. I'm your host, David Bloch, and with me in the studio is my co-host, Ben Shockman. How are you doing tonight, Ben?
I'm really well, thank you. I think you were just very, very loud. We've woken everyone up at 6 o'clock.
Well, that's important because you can get drowsy in this weather. Right Now Radio is on every Thursday night at 6 to 6:30pm on 3CR, 8:55am, and we're talking about the latest human rights issues, events and news from across Australia. And today we're going to be talking about to Beck Goodborn. I think I checked her pronunciation. And Beck's going to be talking about everyone's favourite topic, Melbourne's laneways. Melbourne's laneways have become a lot more prominent in the last few years. They've, as everyone knows, they're the subject of that fabulous campaign with the woman twining a ball of string around the city with some other guy, I think leading to the implication that if you knit a lot, you're going to get lucky and look hot. It's described as...
Can you say that again? That was kind of hot.
That was just off the top of my head. It's described in some of the propaganda as often missed by tourists, Melbourne's laneways are a veritable treasure trove of bars, restaurants, galleries and boutiques. Narrow enclaves where mainstream culture takes a back seat to allow for one-off boutiques, unique galleries, tiny cafes and hidden bars. With Beck, we might be exploring a slightly different side of that, but we'll get to that a bit later in the program. We're going to start off with some human rights news and events.
So a couple of big ticket items, I guess, that have been in the news this week. We kicked off with a debate in Parliament about the war in Afghanistan and our politicians talking about Australia's ongoing involvement in the Afghanistan war. So interesting to see how some of our political leaders are being cornered into having to talk about various attitudes and Australia's ongoing involvement. So I guess, obviously, from a human rights perspective, just important to bear in mind some of the reasons why we went into Afghanistan in the first place and now perhaps some of the sort of ongoing rebuilding efforts that we need to think about going forward.
And my understanding is Julia Gillard, I haven't read much in detail about this, but she said that we're going to be there for another 10 years, potentially, is that?
I think that is what she said. And I guess as most listeners all know, it's one question to go in and just tear apart in the entire country, but then there's a whole lot of rebuilding that needs to go on in terms of political infrastructure, legal infrastructure, social and economic and all the rest of it. So important to bear that in mind as well. Maybe a couple of other big items that have been in the news. Finally, some movement on the immigration detention front. So after an election campaign that focused on the kind of race to the bottom, as the description was, and stopping the boats, it's now good to see that the wonderful political balance of power that we have now means that the Greens can have a little bit of influence around this question of children in immigration detention, of being able to, it seems like, negotiate a deal for children and their families to be released over the next 6 to 9 months, which is excellent news. I guess maybe one of the not-so-good pieces of news that came with that is the fact that the government announced that they'll be opening two more immigration detention facilities. So still maintaining this policy of mandatory immigration detention. And the other aspect, I guess, of children in immigration detention that we want to bear in mind is that it hasn't actually, while the policy's been changed, that hasn't related or resulted in any changes to the Migration Act itself. So we may well see the government just changing its mind for whatever political circumstances sometime in the future, and they don't necessarily have to change anything in relation to the laws. And then one other issue we were just talking about briefly before we came on air was the inquest into the death of Tyler Cassidy. I think this is an issue that we've talked about a little bit on this show over the last little while. This Tyler Cassidy was a 15-year-old boy who was shot by police in November, so about 18 months ago, November 2008, from memory. And finally, the coronial inquest into those incidents, or that incident, is now underway. And I guess maybe just from a human rights perspective, it's important to think about the coronial inquest process being part of the right to life and the procedural duty to investigate when the right to life has been violated and life has been taken away, and steps that are taken and recommendations that are made to ensure that these types of things don't happen again. So some of the questions that are being looked into are issues around police use of force when they actually use force, independent investigation and oversight mechanisms, and I guess cultural training and education for the police force as well.
And I guess it'll be interesting to see as well how that all plays together with recent Office of Police Integrity investigations into police use of force and those kind of issues, where we're going to see what they do and also what kind of follow-up should happen following these kind of incidents.
Yeah, indeed. So there was the OPI report, I think, that was released earlier this week, and it basically criticised the police for the fact that whenever you have police involved in shootings or things along those lines, that you get police investigating police rather than any independent oversight mechanism. So the human rights principle, at least, is that to undertake that investigation, you need a body that's institutionally and hierarchically independent. And if you've just got the homicide squad coming in, then it, at least from a perception perspective, raises questions about whether or not they're genuinely independent. So I think that inquest is probably meant to last for about 5 weeks, I think. So
yeah, apparently there's about 100 witnesses, so it's going to be interesting and potentially a little bit of a circus, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, indeed. But good to see at least that the media is following it, and there are some of these important issues that are being ventilated in the media.
Yes. Well, you're listening to Right Now Radio on 3CR 8:55 AM. It is now 6:08, and as mentioned, tonight we're talking to Bec Goodborn, who is doing her PhD.
Yep.
she's getting well into it, in fact.
Nearly done. Nearly time-wise, nearly done.
And what she's been looking at is in the areas of law and criminology and theory, Melbourne's laneways, and essentially, I guess, maybe I should get Bec to explain more, but I guess looking at the way people interact with those spaces and their kind of experiences, and perhaps what the implications of that is in a way that goes beyond just big balls of wool. So, Bec, can we just start off by talking about the history of Melbourne's laneways and I guess the urban design of Melbourne in itself, because it's a pretty interesting story, I guess.
Yeah, well, the grid was designed by Robert Hoddle, although there's a little bit of controversy about that, but it's generally accepted that it was designed by Robert Hoddle and a couple of other people in 1836. It was laid down on the land of Melbourne. It was imposed on the land, which wasn't particularly suited to the pattern that was put there, but it was put down anyway. In the late 18, Robert Hoddle didn't actually want the little streets that we have, so Little Collins, Little Burke, Flinders Lane, all of those, he didn't want those to be part of the grid, but they were put in at the insistence of the Governor of New South Wales at the time. And so what happened was in the late 30s, there was a huge housing boom. A lot of workshops, shops, industry was built along the little streets, so Little Burke Street, Little Collins Street, which generated a need for access to those buildings. And then in the 50s, we had the gold rush, and so more and more and more things are built along the little lanes, and then more and more and more laneways were built to service those properties. Yep.
So what did those, I guess in the popular imagination of that time, what did those laneways really represent in? I mean, I know that's a, but I guess what I'm getting at is the fact that they weren't necessarily planned originally, and they weren't necessarily what someone who had that vision like Hoddle wanted, so.
No, and a lot of people claim that they were deliberately planned out. The idea of having the small streets where undesirable people might congregate, it was a good idea to not have those spaces in a city to try and stop that from happening. I suppose what they represented to people at the time, I'm not a historian, but looking back at articles from the Argus, often there seems to be articles about people dying there, a lot of prostitution, a lot of filth. They were built to service the properties, so deliveries, and also for night watchmen to come and pick up the toilet. I don't know what it's called.
Night
the
bedpans. Soil,
the night soil. That's the word. The night soil as well.
So no wool or lattes or anything.
No lattes at that time.
So in terms of your research, what have you What have you looked at? What I understand that you've gone and spoken to people in those who use those lanes and tried to get their impressions. What kind of impressions have you got?
Yeah, well, I did observation firstly, and then I spoke to residents, employees of businesses in the laneways, so retail, bars, cafes, restaurants, also to those sorts of services that backed onto the laneways as well, so didn't have a front door entry in a laneway. Spoke to outreach services in laneways, cleaning contractors, City of Melbourne employees, people who just work in the city, artists, tour guides, and people who work in giving information to tourists who come to the city. So coming from that, the biggest thing for me was that there was no real underlying theme to what people were talking to me about. It was incredibly complex, and I found it very difficult to come up with particular positions on things. Obviously, people's perceptions on the laneways are based on what they want from the laneway. And so it was a lot of inconsistency, not only across interviews, so with the different people that I spoke to, but within interviews, I think people were quite conflicted about what they really wanted. Did they want there to be bins there, or do they want to clean them up? A lot of people, like me, aren't quite decided on what they think the best thing to do in the laneways were.
But I guess what were some of people's impressions in terms of how they felt or how they experienced it, I guess, in an emotional sense, in a way?
Well, when I did try and identify some themes that came from that, the major ones that I've looked at to start off...
We're not going to check your footnotes, by the way, so you can generalise for the purpose of radio.
I looked at the idea that... The big themes coming out were ideas of marginality and alternativeness, as well as disorder and the idea of coming across the unexpected or surprises, and also of hiddenness and visibility issues. So for most people, they were concepts that underpinned what they loved about the laneways. So they would describe to me why they loved the laneways, and those were generally the concepts they were drawing on. But on the other hand, those were the very reasons that people would get scared, they would get worried, they wouldn't want to use the laneways because of those things. And I think that came down to me to three things. So the built form, the way that the laneways are physically structured and set up. I think it also has to do with the uses of the laneways, so what people see other people doing in the laneways, and also to the discourse around the laneways. As you so wonderfully demonstrated there, with reading from whatever material that was, in the newspapers, in maps, in the marketing that we have, all those ideas are really played upon and set up, not just for tourists, but I think for us in Melbourne, those ideas are extremely prevalent.
Okay, and in terms of that hiddenness, you know, in terms of that idea that people are looking for this because it has a kind of sexy, you know, you're going to somewhere, you're discovering something. Is there a kind of underside to that in terms of the way people experience it?
Definitely, I think there's an underside to all of those things, not just the hiddenness. That what happens is in some situations, it's positive, that the feeling of being hidden, the feeling of perhaps being a bit alternative, coming across unexpected things can be quite an enjoyable experience. But then for a lot of people, suddenly, for example, if it was dark, being hidden was no longer something they wanted to be. Or another one that comes up a lot is if you smell urine, it's not just that that symbolises disorder for you in that situation, but it really it makes that situation one of disorder and makes that experience one of disorder. And so it can be quite threatening in that way.
It's interesting you mention that because there's this article that a few of us were looking at today, which is about... it's about the sale of laneways. Melbourne City Council's selling off some of their laneways to basically facilitate developments where they might need extra space, or imagine they might need, you know, again, those kind of services. And amongst a lot of people have written comments, and people are kind of passionately to
it's
and for.
Interesting.
Yeah, which I guess is the kind of same. One of them said, yeah, let's preserve every single laneway, complete with the stench of garbage and urine, the syringes, the broken bottles, the dark corners. I bet tourists flock to Melbourne to see that and feel perfectly safe walking up and down every one of them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's something that a lot of people spoke of. But I have to say, when I went out and did observation, wasn't something that I came across a lot. The laneways are actually generally quite clean. I hardly ever came across discarded syringes. Bins could be an issue, but I think a lot of that comes from the way that we talk about the laneways. A lot of those perceptions are actually built on particular images and representations that we have.
Okay. We're just going to take a break and have a go to a quick song. You're on Right Now Radio on 3CR 855 AM. We're going to listen to a track called Medallita by Chico Trujillo, which is a Chilean cumbia band. So enjoy.
Great accent there, Dave.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Whether it's hip-hop, blues, reggae, jazz, opera, roots, curry or world music you're into, 3CR's music menu is serving it up to you.
You're listening to Where With Girls With Women on 3CR.
You're with Music Sans Frontières, music from around Australia and around the world.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Great Voices.
You're listening to Hit Sister Hop on 3CR 855 AM.
It's 25 past 11 o'clock on a Thursday night.
We music, we radio.
Keep these diverse tunes on the air by subscribing to 3CR. Call 9419 8377.
The newspapers shout, a new style is growing.
You're back on Right Now Radio. I'm David Block and I'm here with Beck Goodborn in the studio talking about Melbourne's laneways. And we've just been talking about how although there are people have very different views about them, one of the views they have is, I guess, of a sense of danger, a sense of dirtiness, of those kind of sides of things. And I'm wondering how you think maybe that influences people's perceptions of also the people who inhabit those type of those laneways.
Yeah, well, I think that came up an awful lot because I think a lot of comments from people about why they might not want to go down a laneway often was sort of seeing a dark, shadowy figure or not knowing who you're going to come across. And there was this real idea of trying to avoid the sorts of people that you might find in a laneway. So I think a lot of that marginality and disorder is imparted onto the people who might be using or inhabiting the spaces. I also had a few people say that homeless people added to the character of the laneway, which was astonishing. And I think there, that's that implication of dirtiness and grunge and the non-mainstream as that image of the laneways and all the things in it.
Yeah, so it seems like it kind of has a quite bizarre effect because people both want it and don't want it and feel positive and negative. So I guess it must be complicated to think about how it affects, I guess, those inhabitants who might end up being demonised or being...
I was just going to jump in. You've mentioned kind of marginality and disorder a couple of times, which is really interesting, because perhaps just thinking maybe from a bit of a human rights perspective, I mean, what type of groups are these laneways, attracting? I'm just thinking about it from a kind of freedom of association and expression in terms of artists or, you know, that kind of marginalised people that are accumulating in our laneways.
Yeah. Well, I think it really depends, firstly, on the laneway. A lot of laneways attract commercial interests. Other laneways attract artists, and there do tend to be a few patterns. I spoke to someone who had coordinated a lot of artists as part of her master's program to coordinate a lot of artists to work in the city, and they all tended to work in the same kind of area in the city. So, and there are certain laneways that are known more for drug use and for people sleeping there. And that came through in speaking to people who did things like cleaning, who worked in surrounding businesses. So I think it really depended on the laneway as to who was attracted there. I think more and more there's a lot of apartment blocks being built. There's more residents in the city, which has its positive effects in that there are people who are perhaps taking a bit of responsibility for the space. But also I think the more you get commercial interests, the more people you have competing in a laneway with competing interests, the more difficult it gets for particular voices to be heard about what happens there.
And I guess in terms of the article that Dave was just talking about was in the Age today about the city of Melbourne kind of selling off these types of laneways for, you know, corporate building and, you know, building of apartment blocks and that type of thing. It's interesting to think about what role or decisions the government can take, whether it's to clean up particular laneways or to maybe turn a bit of a blind eye. Did you come across kind of any of that sense of what the government might be turning its mind to or not when looking at these types of issues?
I don't think it tends to turn a blind eye in the laneways, apart from having an extremely contradictory policy on street art, where some things are street art and some things are graffiti, some things have permit and some things don't have a permit. Other than that, I think maybe less so the government making decisions, but certainly the things that are getting licensed to be built in the laneways tend to be the more commercial ventures. So a lot of bars and things have the ability to have outside seating, that kind of stuff, whereas outreach places don't tend to have those. And I think there have been instances where that hasn't gotten off the ground. A few other programs, ground up programs, and there are some. So there's been things like the Laneway Cricket and movie nights and things like that in the laneways, but a few other ground up initiatives for having markets and installations and interactive art, I suppose, in the laneways have been more difficult to get permits for.
Just changing tack a little bit.
Yeah.
I've spoken to you a little bit before about how sometimes these ideas for positive regulation, I guess, for improving these spaces, for using physical space to actually making it a better environment, to reduce marginality, you think that maybe it has, I guess, a few different sides to it, that it's got its positives and its negatives. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'm certainly not the first to critique those sorts of approaches. I mean, my background is criminology, and so the big theory there is the idea of designing out crime or crime prevention through environmental design. So the idea that you can manipulate or control somebody's behaviour through the built environment, and I guess, although it's an extremely huge and complicated body of work, I think it essentially boils down to trying to make things more risky or painful for a potential offender and reduce the pleasure in offending. And the most common things that you see, especially in the city of Melbourne, I suppose, the most common tactics are surveillance measures and also target hardening, which is removing or securing potential targets for crime. So examples are when you see those little metal notches on seats and things like that that make it difficult to lie down on or uncomfortable to lie down on, metal ridges in steps and raised edges so people can't skateboard on it. So those kinds of measures, I think, can make spaces uncomfortable, and they can definitely reduce the desire to spend time there. There've been, for example, Federation Square, you know, there can be bad side effects of doing it. Federation Square is designed to be unattractive to skateboarders. The ground is quite uneven. But of course, people with mobility aids have great difficulty negotiating that terrain. So it's not as apolitical as it can sometimes seem, in that these measures generally affect disproportionately a certain portion of the population who can't often, because it also involves things like removing water taps, putting gates across spaces. So that's going to affect people who perhaps can't go elsewhere or find those services elsewhere.
I mean, do you think there are these kind of so-called clean-up measures, I guess, that also try and think about those kind of things and try and, I guess, take people who are marginalised but actually allow them to continue using a space, but at the same time actually make it less marginalised in a way, less risky, less dangerous?
Yeah.
Assuming that it is in the first place, I guess.
I suppose, like we talked before about sort of cleaning up the laneways, and in a very literal sense, I'm quite happy with cleaning up the laneways and keeping the spaces clean. There's an amazing amount of rubbish in the city of Melbourne that all goes straight into the Yarra. So I'm definitely fine with cleaning up the laneways so those kinds of implications for the people spending time there aren't so bad. But I think it's some of the other measures that can have those detrimental effects.
I mean, in the last 30 seconds, maybe we can just talk about an example being you've mentioned to me the rubbish bins, this issue of whether...
Yeah.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So, you know, for a lot of people, the rubbish bins being present in the laneways can be an issue. They're dirty. And I hadn't thought about it, but when I spoke to one outreach worker, he was very concerned. The City of Melbourne has a new local law that says you can't keep your rubbish bins in public spaces anymore, which means you have to move them out of the laneways unless you have a permit. And this outreach worker was very concerned about the effects that would have for some of his clients who use the bins for shelter, to sleep behind so that they don't get harassed. And somebody I spoke to talked about the importance of using the bins to find things like cups to get water and stuff like that. So while that's not a situation I'd be wanting to promote, that people are relying on bins for day-to-day living, it's also something that hasn't necessarily been considered as part of this process.
Or perhaps addressed as well in thinking about alternative ways. You know, maybe if that's not the basic way that you want to look after people, what other ways there are. We're going to have to end it there. It's 6:30. You've been listening to Right Now Radio on Melbourne's 3CR 8:55 AM. I'm your host, David Bloch, and I've been co-hosting with Ben Chockman. And we've had Beck Goodburn on the show, Goodborn, getting out of the house and away from her PhD.
Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to get in touch with us at Right Now Radio, please call us on 9419 8377, or send us an email on radio@rightnow.org.au. We'll catch you next Thursday at 6 PM on 3CR. Keep listening to 3CR. Up next is Mujeres Latinoamericas. Thanks for listening to Right Now Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed the show.
And perhaps just to take you out tonight, we're going to play our theme song, Paul Kelly's From Little Things, Big Things Grow. And the reason for that is, some of you may have heard, the same Aboriginal community that I think it was about 40 years ago walked off the land in protest against the lack of wages and slave labour that was going on, has earlier this week walked off their land again because of the abolishment of the CDE programs up there. So we'll dedicate this song to them.